Before I became the host of this program 20 years ago, I had had a lot of experience behind the microphone, but that did little to lessen my anxiety. After all, I was about to take the seat occupied by the first host of Weekend Edition, a national treasure, Susan Stamberg, who was and continues to be a mentor. How could I even think of filling her shoes? But she had confidence in me, which made me a little more confident. When I began in 1989, we had 200,000 listeners. Today, that number is close to 3 million. But numbers are not my measure of success. Success for me is knowing that you've made the time all these years to listen to the show. Success for me is the willingness of our member stations to keep our program on the air. But I also want you to know that I am not the one responsible for the success and longevity of this program. That belongs to the people whose voices you don't hear. Every editor, producer, director, engineer, and reporter who has ever worked on the show, they are the ones who have made me sound so good for so long, and I'm profoundly grateful. Even after 20 years, I'm still not used to getting up early on a Sunday morning, but knowing you are there has made it all worthwhile. Thank you. This is NPR's Weekend Edition. Directed by Sarah Beyer Kelly and produced by Elaine Heinzman, Kimberly Adams, Carolyn Beeler, Thomas Pierce, Andy Lyman, Eamon Malone, and Julia Holmes Bailey. Our interns are Annika Robbins and Sarah Molnar. Burke Hunn is our technical director. Our web producer is Melissa Goh, and Kimaleski and Barbara Van Workum are our reference librarians. Our program was produced today by Ned Wharton and edited by Jeffrey Bennett and senior editor Jenny Bergall. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Devar Iran Ardalan. I'm Leanne Hansen. Scientists studying a crevasse in the Ethiopian desert say we may be witnessing the birth of a future ocean. In 2005, a 35-mile-long rift broke open as two parts of the African continent separated. Researchers from several countries have confirmed that the volcanic processes at work beneath the Ethiopian rift are nearly identical to those at the bottom of the world's oceans. They say it's likely the beginning of a new sea. Joining us to talk about this is Cindy Ebinger, professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, and she joins us from NPR member station WXXI. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How long have you been studying this rift in the Ethiopian desert?
At the start of this recent activity that started in September 2005, I had actually been doing work with scientists in Ethiopia, most notably Atalay Ayeli and Gezahayn Nyurgu. And we'd been looking at the area and making some predictions, and then the earthquake sequences started, and I came a little bit afterward and put in some seismometers so we could just record then the activity and try and actually track the magma movement.
Now, can you explain exactly how that happens? What exactly is happening with the volcanic magma?
Well, in this area, Africa and Arabia are splitting apart. And it's not just one straight line. There's actually two parallel zones, and they're about 2 or 3 miles wide. And in this case, then, the plates are being pulled apart. But underneath, there are little bits of molten rock that are moving upward, and they're accumulating quite deep down, maybe 10 miles down below the surface. That's the part that we still don't understand completely. But subsequent to that, we've had 12 additional periods where big, long sheets of magma have risen up and cracked open the rocks lying above, so really creating this new ocean floor.
Mm. Why is this so unusual?
It's actually not an unusual process in terms of Earth history. This process is happening along mid-ocean ridges worldwide, but by the time a ship is mobilized, we may have missed all of this activity. Here, this is one of the few places on the surface of the Earth right now where we have this process occurring, so it's a unique study location.
Yeah, you can see it happening.
Yes, we can.
So when do you think there will be a new ocean?
Buying oceanfront property in the Afar Desert is a bit premature. Maybe in another 100,000 years or 500,000 years, it would be the ocean will be there.
Cindy Ebinger is a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, and she joined us from NPR member station WXXI. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Mixed-race Americans are among the country's fastest-growing demographic groups, and they're helping to change the way America thinks about racial identity. On the 2000 census, for the first time, Americans were given the opportunity to check more than one box for race. At the time, nearly 7 million people identified themselves as being multiracial. Nicholas Jones is the chief of the U.S. Census Bureau's Racial Statistics Branch.
There has been a substantial increase in the multiracial population through our population estimates data. The numbers have actually increased about 25% from 2000 to 2008, according to the population estimate. And these are mainly driven by birth to children from interracial parent couples.
Researchers say with more interracial marriages, there is more social acceptance. Alan Goodman is a professor of biological anthropology at Hampshire College in Massachusetts.
There were certain barriers to having individuals of different ethnic groups and cultures coming together. The first one was barriers of space, but in 1492, those barriers began to fall. Then there were barriers of law in the United States, and those finally fell in the 1960s. And then I think the real changes that's taking place are changes in the way people think about themselves.
Today, we begin a three-part series on race we're calling Beyond Black and White. And the topic of multiracial identity is the focus of a new book called Blended Nation. It combines portraits of mixed-race Americans with their stories of living beyond the sometimes rigid notions of race. Mike Tauber and Pamela Singh are the husband and wife team who compiled the book, Blended Nation. They join us from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Why publish a book about this particular topic, and why now?
Well, the face of the nation is changing at a rapid rate due to an expanding demographic of mixed race individuals in the U.S.
Yeah, and we felt that to really tap into that, Pamela's mixed, and she's always dealt with the "what are you" question, and sort of floated the idea of writing a book about it. And as a photographer, I felt the most powerful way to explore this would be through photographs. And also to interview the people that we photographed.
You've been working on the book for some 7 years now, but did the rise and success of Barack Obama, the first multiracial president, affect this at all?
I think, well, from beginning of this project 7 years ago, you know, with Obama now in the White House, you know, I would say, you know, as Rebecca Walker wrote in her foreword, that it's currently hip to be mixed. What's interesting to us is that Obama chose to self-identify as black and not mixed race. But I think he was able to use his biracial heritage to appeal to a much broader audience than he would have been able to if he was just black or white. Mm. And it's what's fascinating to us is that many people think that this topic is no longer relevant now that we have Obama as our president, that we live in a post-race America, and if anything, we've found the opposite to be true, you know, in the past year.
Pam, what is your mixed-race heritage?
I am East Indian and black.
So how did your own life experience the sense of existing between two perceived racial categories inform your work on this book?
Well, I would say, like many people in the book, during the teenage years, you know, there's definitely a sense of confusion and identity issues where you don't really know where you fit in. Later on in your 20s, you start seeing it as more of a benefit that you're able to have a much broader worldview since you're coming from two different, you know, having two different backgrounds, I should say.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Mike Tauber and Pamela Singh, their husband and wife and authors of the book Blended Nation. As we mentioned, 2000 was the first year Americans were given the chance to choose more than one racial category on census surveys. Why are these racial boxes even relevant? I mean, isn't race more of a social construct than a biological one?
The concept of race and ethnicity and ancestry, they're so highly muddled and they're so nebulous. And they're so strongly linked to the visual in terms of skin color and hair texture. Yet so many of our educational and social and business and governmental policies are based on fixed racial categories.
And we really wanted to know what it was like for somebody who has who checks more than one box, what it's like to exist in that realm.
What's it like
what it's like to not be wholly part of one or another, but yet be all.
But a lot of these individuals are caught in the middle of racial categories, you know. And we've had a few people in Blended Nation. One girl in particular looked black. She's half black and half white. She was raised by white grandparents, and she identifies as white. But if you look at her, she looks like me. She looks black.
Mm. It varies within families too. You know, as one girl shared a story about her father, who's black, white, and Native American, who was considerably darker than his sister. And his sister, back during segregation, was able to drink out of the whites only fountain. He was not. Mm. So, you know, even if you have the same mix as somebody else, if you happen to be darker or lighter, or if you happen to be raised by, you know, one half of your heritage as opposed to another, that can really play into your whole sense of identity.
In a moment, we're going to speak to one of the people that was profiled in your book. And there are several people and several stories who categorize themselves in ways that conflict, as you say, with how society sees them. But skin color, of course, is a determining factor in one's mixed race experience. But socioeconomic status is too. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's socioeconomic, it's geography, and it's a type of what mix you are. We found that the people who are black and white have a very different experience maybe than someone who's Asian and black or Asian and white.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, you know, the community you grew up in. If, you know, oftentimes if you grow up, if you're half white and half black, for instance, and you grow up in a predominantly a minority or black or non-white community, you're going to get some people that say you're not black enough. But if you grew up in a white community, you're going to get people saying you're black.
Mike Tauber and Pamela Singh are the authors of Blended Nation, and they joined us from NPR member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Cheryl Quintana Leader is among the dozens of mixed-race Americans profiled in the book Blended Nation. She's a filmmaker, and we reached her in Long Beach, California. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
Since racial perception is closely linked to visual clues, describe to us what you look like.
I have fair skin. It's a little on the yellow side. I have blue eyes, wide cheekbones, full lips.
The blue eyes, where do they come from in your family?
My mother's Mexican and my father's Caucasian. And so the blue eyes came from the Germans who hid out in Mexico during World War II to escape, you know, being convicted or punished for their crimes. And of my mother's background, that's where my blue eyes came in.
You say in the book, because you are fair-skinned and you have blue eyes, mm-hmm. many people assume you're white, but how do you identify yourself?
I identify myself as an American, Mexican, Indian, Russian, German, Polish, French descent.
So what do you check on the census? What did you check on the 2000 census?
I checked other, and I was proud to put in all the various pieces of the puzzle that make me up.
You mentioned in the book Blended Nation that some of your white friends encourage you to take advantage of being Latina. What do they mean?
I work in the entertainment industry, and they felt that competitions like Hispanic film projects or, you know, diversity programs that would allow other writers of other ethnicities into that career, they're like, oh, aren't you Hispanic? You know, why don't you take advantage of this? Or sometimes they would say it in a more sarcastic way, meaning that they don't get those privileges, but I guess we do.
Mm. Why do you say that some in the Latino community have said you aren't Latina enough?
Oh, because then later on I joined an organization for Latina filmmakers, and I was in a room, and because you don't speak fluent Spanish or you don't come from the neighborhood or you don't look a certain way, they don't... I guess it's based on a degree of, you know, Latino enough or Latina enough or Mexican-ness. And I recall telling them that, you know, if anybody has any issues about why I'm in an organization fighting for rights for Latinas to be in entertainment and have the right to do, you know, write and direct and produce, then, you know, they need to come to me. They didn't say a word the whole time, and I find out later on, no one said a word when I said that because no one at the table spoke fluent Spanish. And they were all from the neighborhood. They were all Mexican. They grew up in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, they had different social rules that said they couldn't speak Spanish either, even though they were Mexican or El Salvadorian or Peruvian or Colombian.
Mm. But you identify yourself as American.
Yeah, I say American.
California-based filmmaker Cheryl Quintana Leader is profiled in the book Blended Nation. You can see images from the book, including one of Cheryl, at our website, npr.org. While you're there, share your own thoughts and insights about the conversations you heard today. Our series Beyond Black and White continues next week, when we'll examine the tensions in one of the country's most racially diverse states, Hawaii.
A postscript now to a story we brought you yesterday. It's about Darvin Moon, a small-stakes poker player from rural Maryland who made it past 6,500 players to the final table at the World Series of Poker. Now, normally, Moon runs a small-scale logging operation in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. His poker strategy is simple. He doesn't do a lot of bluffing, he doesn't study the game, and he doesn't use math skills. But before he left for the tournament in Las Vegas, Moon told me he does have a killer instinct.
The part I like about the most is see how many chips you can get out of somebody else when you know you got them beat. When they say they're all in and I know I got them, I just outplayed them. That's what I like about poker.
Well, Darvin Moon joined eight other players around the table yesterday, a marathon game that went on into the morning. Here's how a pair of ESPN podcasters relayed the news.
Welcome to the Poker Edge here on ESPNRadio.com. Andrew Feldman alongside Bernard Lee, and we are both tired. We watched 18 hours of the World Series of Poker main event final table.
That's right, 18 hours of almost continuous poker play. That's a World Series of Poker record. And Darvin Moon was able to outlast seven of his eight opponents. Now it's down to two. Tomorrow night, he'll go heads up against 21-year-old Joe Catta for the grand prize. At stake, $8.5 million. Not bad for Moon. His foray into tournament poker began earlier this year with an investment of $30. But his opponent, Joe Catta, now has twice as many chips as Moon, so we suspect Darvin might be a little nervous.
Hell, you can't make me nervous.
Or maybe not. Shortly after the 18-hour session, ESPN's Bernard Lee caught up with Moon.
So you're about a 2-to-1, or maybe 2.5-to-1 chip underdog, but are you comfortable in the situation you're in right now?
I'm always comfortable. Give me one chip and I'm comfortable.
Did exhaustion start settling at 6 o'clock Pacific time? Were you tired at all?
I'm good to go.
You got a little bit more than 24 hours. What are you going to do? Are you going to rest up?
They got a Texas Hold'em bonus table waiting on me up the hall here.
That's Darvin Moon, finalist for the World Series of Poker Championship.
Know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You don't ever count your money while you're sitting at the table.
Our program today is directed by Petra Mayer. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Alice Winkler, Kenya Young, Travis Larchuk, and Matt Sennewald. The technical director is Sean Phillips, assisted today by Paris Morgan, Arthur Halliday Laurent, Cal Southworth, and Mark Greenhouse. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our reference librarian is Keen Molesky. Rick Holter is the senior editor. The senior producer is Matt Martinez. For Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Have a great week.
And when he finished speaking, he turned back.
The House of Representatives passed landmark legislation overnight, the Affordable Health Care for America Act, its version of health care reform. President Obama hailed the bill today, even though his plan to overhaul health care still has significant hurdles to overcome.
Now it falls on the United States Senate to take the baton and bring this effort to the finish line on behalf of the American people. And I'm absolutely confident that they will. And I'm equally convinced that on the day that we gather here at the White House and I sign comprehensive health insurance reform legislation into law, They'll be able to join their House colleagues and say that this was their finest moment in public service.
The question now is how much of what the House passed last night will eventually become the law. Well, Jonathan Oberlander might have the answer. He teaches healthcare politics at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Jonathan Oberlander, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
The White House is touting last night's vote as a landmark moment, a move they say as significant as the 1965 law that created Medicare. But this bill now may not actually resemble what eventually becomes the law, right?
I think if you look at the bill that the House passed last night, major provisions of the bill are likely to become law and will be in the Senate bill, including the regulation of private insurance, the provision of subsidies to low-income and middle-income Americans, a mandate that Americans must have health insurance. So all those central pillars, I think, are likely to survive.
Mm. Well, what specifically did the House pass that might not get through the Senate and land on the president's desk?
Well, the most obvious part of the legislation would be the national public plan that they enacted in the House bill. That is a Medicare-like public insurance option available to uninsured Americans under the age of 65 and small businesses. In addition to the public plan, if you look at the financing in the House bill, that may not survive through the Senate. The House relies to a great extent on increasing income taxes, the so-called millionaire's tax, for affluent Americans. So far, the Senate has wanted no part of that.
Jonathan Oberlander, anyone watching the debate in the House yesterday would have noticed Michigan Congressman John Dingell presiding from the Speaker's chair. He actually did the same thing in 1965 when Medicare was being debated. Was that debate as contentious?
It was, and it's worth remembering that Medicare, although it is a very popular program right now, if you look back at the debate, it was a very contentious debate, a very partisan debate. The idea for Medicare was first announced in 1952. The first legislation for Medicare was introduced in Congress in 1957, and there was an 8-year fight and a very bitter fight.
You've written about the history of Medicare and how it was never really designed as a plan to serve just senior citizens, that it was seen as kind of the first step in introducing universal health care in America.
That's right. Medicare was a reaction to the defeat of the Truman administration's plan for national health insurance in the late 1940s. The idea was that Medicare would be the cornerstone for a universal national health insurance system. You would start with the elderly, then you would add in children, and eventually you would cover all Americans. It never happened that way.
If Medicare was seen in that way as a sort of the first step, why didn't it go further in the subsequent years?
Two major reasons. The first is that the political landscape changed. The advocates of Medicare grew up in the New Deal, and they grew up in a world where Democrats really dominated. And what they could not foresee in 1965 is that within a decade, American politics was going to shift to the right with the election of Richard Nixon and then the economic problems of the 1970s and a real erosion in the faith of government. All of that made it very difficult to expand Medicare. The second thing that happened after Medicare, and partly as a result of Medicare, was an explosion of health care inflation. And we had very high health care costs in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And so really the dominant question in Congress became not how to expand the Medicare program, but how to control spending in the U.S. health care system.
Do you suspect that some members of Congress view this current legislation, you know, in the same way as kind of the opening step in eventually getting a system of universal health care in place?
Well, you can argue this is a much bigger step than Medicare and significantly less incremental in that it's not based on demography, it's not based on age group, but it's trying to create a system of at least universal access to health insurance. And this is not going to be the last step in health reform. This is going to be the beginning rather than the end. And you can bet that many members of Congress are going to come back and want to fill in the holes in the American healthcare system over time.
That's Jonathan Oberlander. He's the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare. He teaches healthcare policy at the University of North Carolina. Professor Oberlander, thank you so much.
Thank you again.
The health of the planet will top the agenda in Copenhagen next month at a meeting of environmental officials from around the world. Organizers hope to hammer out a major new treaty to fight global warming. This past week, negotiators met in Barcelona for the final proceedings before the Copenhagen event. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the rift between the United States and some of the world's poorest nations grew even wider.
Every nation will eventually have to take action to address climate change. The fight now is who does what when. At a news conference in Barcelona, U.S. diplomat Jonathan Pershing laid out what the United States wants to happen. The rich industrial nations will recommit to reducing their emissions. Meanwhile, major developing countries will have to slow down the rate at which their emissions are growing.
China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, many, many others are beginning to outline their domestic efforts to do just this.
The world's poorest countries, like Niger and Côte d'Ivoire, won't have to cut emissions at all, but they will need to start figuring out how they can develop with clean energy. Under the deal Pershing envisions, rich countries will help them to do that. As part of this package, the United States wants all countries, rich and poor, to agree to let the world review and judge their plans. And this is where the rift between rich and poor appears. Pershing says the developing world won't agree to submit formal plans for other nations to see.
They would like us to make binding commitments on finance, binding commitments on emissions targets, and they are not even prepared to take a review obligation, much less make it binding.
This refusal stems from a deal that was negotiated long ago. Under the Kyoto Climate Treaty of 1997, developing countries were given a free pass on all obligations, and they're loath to give that up.
The developing countries in particular would like a legal deal that applies to us but not to them. And we are not prepared to have such an agreement.
The developing countries naturally have a different take on all of this. They point out that the United States and Europe are responsible for most of the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so the poor nations say it's the job of the rich nations to fix the problem. Martin Kaur runs the South Center, which is a research group funded by the developing world. He says poor nations want the rich to slash emissions by a dramatic 40% in the next decade, and even the most ambitious promises come nowhere close.
So the developing countries are aghast, that's the word, aghast, astonished at such a low level of commitment.
Another part of the rift is over money. Poor countries say they need a huge amount of money to deal with climate change, much more than is on the table. They're asking for at least 1% of the rich countries' gross domestic product.
1% of GNP is $400 billion to 5% of GNP. This is a proposal of the Africa Group.
At one point this week, African nations walked out of the talks to press their demands. Eventually, they went back in, but the rift persists. Jake Schmidt from the Natural Resources Defense Council says part of this is a negotiating tactic. Poor nations may eventually agree to develop plans and let the world review them, but they're not prepared to say so just yet.
I'm not surprised that they won't budge on that until they know exactly what the U.S. is going to do.
And the U.S. isn't quite sure itself what it will put on the table in Copenhagen. Any deal will need to be ratified with 67 votes in the U.S. Senate, and it's not yet clear how far the Senate will go on climate commitments. U.S. diplomats don't want to cut a deal in Copenhagen that will be a dead letter in Washington. Richard Harris, NPR News.